Rory.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good, good, good. So we've both dropped the kids to work, and we're ready to discuss some interesting stuff.
Yeah. I thought this case would be nice to talk over. You want me to hop right in?
Sure, hop right in. Well, just as a background for anyone who hasn't listened to the last time we spoke and discussed, we're going to go over a couple of a case that Rory recently had involving venous congestion and the use of portal vein hepatic ultrasound to assess that. So go right ahead.
So this was the case of a 61-year-old gentleman that was transferred to us for ARDS, but essentially had been admitted to an outside hospital for multifocal pneumonia that ended up being MSFA. He was in shock at the time, requiring vasopressors, and had a pretty aggressive fluid resuscitation over the first few days. I think when he got to us, he ended up being about 10 to 12 liters positive. And then was transferred to us for management of ARDS and possible ECMO evaluation. When he got to us that first night, he probably got to us around 6 p.m. or so, was on Levo and Vaso with MAPS around 65 or so, on pretty significant vent settings, PEEP of 16, FiO2 of 100, satting at around 86 or so. Paralyzed.
Okay.
So that was his initial presentation.
Pretty sick guy.
So, you know, yeah, pretty sick. And so we kind of took a hold of the situation and kind of looked, and during our initial assessment, I did a quick focus. And on our initial assessment, his heart was pretty full and large. He had a pretty big right ventricle. The ratio was about 1-to-1, but it was still moving pretty well. His TAPC was around 20 or so. He had good cardiac output with a BTI of 24. His lungs were full of fluid. His IVC was big and plump. And on that initial assessment of looking at his venous side, his hepatic vein still had kind of normal morphology, but he did have reasonable pulsatility in his portal vein. It didn't quite meet the 50% threshold that's used in most of the literature. I think when you did the math, it was about 43%. But it was clear there was a lot of pulsatility in it.
Okay.
So, you know, in this ICU, you get signed out to a night team. So we were kind of seeing him within the last hour of our shift.
Right.
And the sign out was, you know, tuck him in, get him on good vent settings, try to do some recruitment. We had actually flipped him to APRV, and actually by the time we had left, it got him down to, I think, 40% FiO2. And so, you know, our thought was, I think a lot of this is fluid and not true ARDS.
Right.
And to try to level him off and see if you could start de-resuscitating him at some point. Unfortunately, over the night, his kind of fluid, his urine output kind of went to close to zero, and the night team did what is, I think, typical of most people would do, was give him some more fluid, and he got about 2 liters extra overnight. So when we got to him in the morning, he had worsened his shock, his pressor requirements had gone up, and his venous pulsatility was now really obvious. So he had quite exceptional portal vein pulsatility with a difference of about 50%. I think it was 53%. And he now had pretty prominent reversal of hepatic flow. It wasn't, you know, a biphasic wave, but with respiratory variation, you'd see a flipping of the diastolic and systolic waves, and then the atrial wave was really prominent. I don't know. Can we show these images on your website?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. We'll put
them. You can put them in. So our thought at this point was he's pretty fluid overloaded, and we've got significant venous congestion. So we actually started to diurese him. He was actually making good urine at this time, and didn't need any dialysis. So we diuresed him with Lasix and metolazone. And over the next 3 or 4 days, we pulled off a huge amount of fluid. He was negative 2 to 3 liters a day. Within the first day, he was off all his pressors.
Wow.
And by day four, we had him extubated. Yeah, it's a high flow.
Awesome. Awesome. I mean, I think there's a handful of good little points in there. I mean, I think right off the bat, as you said, the diagnosis of ARDS is kind of put into question, whether it's a true ARDS or an iatrogenic ARDS.
Right.
And I have to say, like, I think I'd mentioned that before as well. I've, in the last, like, 5 years, I've maybe have a couple of cases of what I would call genuine ARDS. The rest has all been, you know, has all been really iatrogenic saltwater drowning, well-intentioned as it may be.
Right. I mean, you have to wonder how many patients that come in with normal lungs, how many of them who get ARDS in the hospital that we do it to.
Yeah, I think it's the majority. I think it's the majority still. So that's I think that's the point number one. Number two, it's just awesome that you managed to catch all those at the times of entry, and then as soon as, because it's hard to believe that someone would come in, you know, critically ill, would then worsen, and then you'd be able to turn them around that quick with the diuresis, and it worsened
right
overnight, concomitant with the fluid, you know, infusion for the low urine output. So it's really neat that in a way the fact that two teams were working on the patient allowed you to capture these radically different changes
right
in physiology
right
and therapy.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, now that I've been doing a lot of this portal vein flow, I actually find, find during a resuscitation, you can watch it start to become pulsatile. And it doesn't have to meet the threshold that someone would qualify as venous congestion at 50%.
Right.
I find the portal
arbitrary
vein flow is very sensitive. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think André uses 30% as what he considered mm-hmm. or so far as sounds significant. But, you know, it's like any other threshold. It's like someone decided somewhere, well, it looks like this kind of splits into two, but any individual patient, you know, could be very significant at 20 and the other one could be okay till 50. Who knows? Very hard
right
for us.
And these are all kind of retrospective studies looking at a cutoff.
Right.
I think
eventually,
as soon as you start seeing that pulsatility, I think I'm starting to worry.
Yeah, I think it's with the data that you're going to come out, and then hopefully more and more will come, we'll hopefully learn that that's like a hard stop point, you know, and a hard stop and diuresis, you know. Maybe just that
right
full IVC with the plump hepatic veins, but all other flow tracings are okay. That's just a stop sign, you know. But then once you start seeing that, it's like, okay, back up. Let's get this fluid off.
Yeah.
So really,
and I don't know about you. I find the portal is, maybe it's just easier to see the flow variation on the Doppler signal, but I find
mm-hmm.
it far more sensitive. Like I find I start seeing differences or phasicity in the flow in the portal vein way before I see it in the hepatic vein.
Well, that's awesome. I mean, I think that's a really good case, and definitely we'll put up the pictures, and I'll put up a little post about that. And it'll be interesting to see if you can bring those to H&R. And obviously, a good amount of the focus in our great fluid debate will be around that. It'll be good to bring forward your sort of very recently acquired but intensely acquired experience on this, which will be a really nice contribution, because I know a lot of André's work is in the ICU, but predominantly this is post-op hearts, as you worked
right
as a cardiac anesthetist, intensivist. So a lot of it is intra-op, post-op, immediate. So it'll be nice to apply that stuff to outside community patients.
The first thing we're finding is just trying to figure out how often do you see it in sepsis. I mean, I don't think we even have a good role at that. So at this point, we're just trying to collect it on everybody and see what, you know, just kind of phenotype how often patients have it, and then
right
try to figure out what it actually means, which, again, I don't know if we have a, you know, we use it in a way that we think it's physiologically reasonable, but trying to actually quantify that and seeing how it actually works and how reliable we have between users and so forth, I think is the next step.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the future of resus is going to involve, you know, a multimodality to look at it. You know, for instance, if you have the ability to see, I remember there was at one point someone using this thing called Pixel Flux software. A German professor had actually come to talk to us about it, but it wasn't quite prime time-ish. It was a little bit complicated to use, but, you know, once that can be automated, you can have something that, you know, looks at the pulsatility, and then it may find the point at which sort of in the organ itself, say the kidneys, at which the perfusion is visibly starting to be impaired, at the sort of even at the arterial side, and we can find other indices to make to have a more sort of individualized stop point or start point, you know, for patients and their fluid resuscitation or de-resuscitation.
Yeah, I the way I view it now is almost like an ultrasound version of the FACT trial, where
exactly.
you have multiple kind of multiple findings of fluid intolerance, including the lungs, the right heart, and then the venous congestion.
Yeah.
I think all of them are conceivable stop points. The question is which ones are, you know, better for diuresis and which ones happen first. And
that
I'm not sure about yet.
Well, because see, one of the interesting, I think it was in the FACT subgroups, that they showed that taking off the fluid after it had been given, you didn't quite get to the same, you know, wellness point as the one who didn't receive it in the first place.
Right, right. That was so that Selmler reanalysis. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was a reanalysis, and then, you know, it maybe fall prey to some of the statistical issues with that. But the concept, you know, it makes some sense. And if we look at it to tie in the glycocalyx, when we know that, you know, when you flood and get the ANPs going, and then you shed your glycocalyx because you were overloaded, well, simply taking off salt and water is not going to fix the damage that was done completely.
Right, and you have to wonder, is this the reason why we've never had a study showing aggressive de-resuscitation actually works? Maybe it's just not putting it in the first place.
Right, exactly. And having just the right light signal to tell us when to slow down and stop.
Yeah.
All right.
Cool.
Well, awesome.
All right,
we'll keep base and keep discussing these cases as they pop up.
Yeah, we'll do. All right.
Talk soon.
All right, talk to you later.